ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
In a country polarized by partisan politics, it's hard to go a day without hearing or seeing a story from Washington or even closer to home in our state capital that doesn't leave us shaking our heads and wondering, what does it all mean? Well, as a listener to WUWM, we like to think that news coverage from NPR and from our local WUWM news staff help to answer some of those questions. But many of the issues are so complex and the politics so toxic that getting a true perspective can still be difficult. That's why the university and our community here in Milwaukee is fortunate to have a terrific department of political science located on the UWM campus. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to talk with Kathy Dolan, distinguished professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the College of Letters and Science. Kathy is frequently interviewed by correspondents from the nation's top news organizations, and recently she was named co-editor of the American Journal of Political Science, one of the most prestigious journals in the field and the one most read and most cited. Welcome, Kathy. Great to have you on the program today.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So what a time to be a political scientist, right?
I'll tell you, it's been like the Super Bowl every day for the last several years.
You know, a lot of people may think that the idea that politics can be studied like a science is sometimes, you know, difficult to understand because it so often is akin to a sport. Some call it a blood sport.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about your view of what political science is.
Well, you know, at its heart, political science is really about studying human behavior, whether it's humans as individuals or part of institutions. But there are fairly predictable patterns to human behavior, both at the individual and institutional level. So what we try to do as political scientists is to use basic social science methods of examining human behavior, examining decision-making processes, examining outcomes in a kind of regularized and orderly fashion to look for patterns, to see if we can make explanations and predictions about those sorts of things. And more of the time, you know, we're successful and we're able to do that. Certainly, there are things that happen that surprise us. There are always things that happen that might, you know, step out of a pattern that we expect. And that's where the human piece of all of this comes in. But, you know, you'd be surprised. We can make pretty good explanations for lots of these phenomena.
How much of the work of a political scientist is looking back at how elections were run or how people were ultimately elected to office, mm-hmm. and versus the time that you spend projecting what might be ahead of us in the future when mm-hmm. you look at the political landscape?
Well, I think we do both of those things, in part because looking backwards helps us establish the patterns that we want to see. Say, for example, a very well-understood phenomenon in American politics is that the political party of a president is very likely to lose seats in Congress in the next midterm election. And so we can go back as far as we have recorded election returns in the United States, and we can see, yes, you know, there was a Democrat in office for president in this time, and then 2 years later, the Democratic Party loses seats in Congress. And so we have patterns that we've observed over a historical period. And then we can say, oh, and look, now we have an exception. Now we have a time when a president's party didn't lose seats or maybe even gain seats. And so what we have is maybe you can look back over 100 years and you can say, you know, 47 times out of 100, you know, 100 this happened, and then three times we saw something different. And so we use the patterns as a baseline. And then we say, all right, so now it's our job to explain why something different happened in this particular election or that particular election. And then that allows us to say, looking forward, if we expect these conditions, here's what we should see happen.
So the people who run these campaigns, perhaps the candidates themselves, often can look at the product of a political scientist to get a better idea of what they should be doing, or does that not always happen?
Well, that doesn't always happen. Political scientists, as academics, are sometimes seen as working not in the real world. We're in the ivory tower. So I think there are colleagues of mine in the discipline who would argue that campaigns, as a good example, sometimes professionals don't necessarily inform their work by using the kinds of things we know and have happen. My own work is a really good example of that, you know, in that I study women candidates when they run for office and how voters react to them. And what I find and what some other scholars find is that a candidate's sex is really not particularly important to whether or not she will be successful in an election. You are pretty hard-pressed to find campaign professionals who will believe those findings because to them, they're out in the world and they might have a woman candidate with whom they're working. And the first voter who comes up and says, "Honey, who's going to take care of your kids while you're in office?" they say, "Well, there you go. You know, her sex is the most important thing that anybody ever thinks about." So professionals and academics sometimes, you know, have a bit of a back and forth about whether or not the world is the way we think it is versus the way they think it is.
Well, and the work that you've done studying women in politics is fascinating because of the fact that today you've got the Me Too movement. You've got the Year of the Woman that was just upon us, and I think you're right. There are a lot of people in the world who are saying, "Well, of course, everything has changed now because society has evolved, and we are thinking of women and their role in society differently than we did a few years ago."
Yes, I think those things are right. You know, gender has certainly had a sort of primary place in American politics since, you know, for a long time, but certainly since 2008 when Hillary Clinton contested for the Democratic primary, and then in 2016 when she was the nominee, and then, you know, President Trump with all of the sort of gendered ways he dealt with the campaign. And now we have six women who have announced their candidacies for president in 2020.
That has to be an all-time high.
It is,
right?
An all-time high, yes, by a good bit. And so, you know, we've really had, in the context of the Me Too movement, in the context of President Trump's presidency, we really have had, you know, just this sort of explosion of activism, you know, among women, both at the elite and the mass level in the last couple of years. And it's brought us to a place, you know, where we have not seen before.
Yeah. Although, again, being a student of political history, as you are, we can look back at the suffragette movement back in the early 1900s. And back then, it must have seemed to be a political shockwave, an earthquake, to have women in the street campaigning for the right to vote, something we take for granted now. But the impact on society back then must have been as profound as we today believe women and their rising role in politics is today.
Well, you know, suffrage is a fascinating story that I don't think Americans know enough about. Next year is the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, so women will have had the right to vote for 100 years next year. And so I'm hoping in political science and in popular culture, we spend a little time on that, you know, because the story of suffrage is a very long one. I mean, it took about 75 years from the first organized efforts to seek the vote for women until the passage of the 19th Amendment. And it took, you know, every ounce of the work of thousands and thousands of people every day of those 75 years to make it a reality. And so women's activism and women's participation in American life is not and was not a new thing. Bringing them into the formal, you know, obviously political world of the right to vote was. But I think if people knew more about the story, they wouldn't be as surprised as they might be today about women's involvement in the contemporary period, because women have always been involved. It's just a question of where they've been sort of allowed to be involved, where they've moved into being involved, and whether or not we see their involvement.
Let's talk a little more about your research, because I've seen some presentations that you've done which have really been quite remarkable in opening my eyes to the potential that women have in politics. Again, you talked about the stereotype image that we have. Well, it's, you know, a woman running today is going to evoke certain responses, but you've taken a really hard look at how successful women can be as candidates.
Yes. I mean, what my work and the work of others shows us is that the primary reason that women are as underrepresented as they are in elected office in the United States is that the number of women who run for office is as low as it is. So there is, you know, the saying that we have that when women run, women win, which is the case. And by that, I don't mean that every time a woman runs, she wins. But women who run for office win at the same rates as men who run for office. So women face no disadvantage as a group. Individual women are going to win or are going to lose, of course. But as a group, women are not disadvantaged. The problem is that the number of women who run is infinitesimally smaller than the number of men who run. And so candidacy is the real roadblock. Once women become candidates, they're very successful. So in 2018, we had a record high number of women run for Congress, and it was a record by about 120 women. And now we have many more women than we've ever had in Congress. Women are still dramatically underrepresented, but when they run, they win at a proportional rate. You know, if women make up 30% of the candidates who run for office, they're going to end up to be about 30% of the winners. And you can't really expect much more than that. So the key really is getting more women to run.
Is there any evidence that would suggest that what happened in 2018 with so many more women becoming candidates is now a pattern that is established, or was this a one-off?
Well, we don't know because we have to wait and see what 2020 is like in 2022 and 2024. You know, the number of women who have been running for office has steadily and slowly increased over time. The difference between the number of women who ran in 2016 and 18 was a big jump. Whether that is maintained in 2020 remains to be seen, but hopefully there is momentum and hopefully there's movement forward.
Well, as you note, next year's the 100th anniversary of women gaining the right to vote, so perhaps that will those news headlines alone will convince other women to get into the lake and start swimming.
Well, we can only hope.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio is Kathy Dolan. Kathy is chair of the Political Science Department at UWM. She's also a distinguished professor at the university, something we're quite proud of. And she recently became co-editor of one of the most influential journals in political science today, the American Journal of Political Science. Let's talk about your role as editor in this publication. What sort of articles do you think that the journal will be filled with in the coming years as you co-edit this this publication?
Well, the goal of the American Journal of Political Science is to publish the best cutting-edge, new, exciting work in political science. So I think that work takes a couple of different forms. One is the sort of emergence of new questions and new topics and new areas in political science. So there are always new questions that we have, as one example. Twitter has become, a popular part of American political culture and popular media. So, we have questions about what impact Twitter can have on individuals or on election campaigns and how it's used. And there are lots of things that we need to understand about, all the changes in social media. So those are new areas. When I was in graduate school, none of those kinds of questions. We would have asked those questions about television. We would have asked those questions about radio.
Or campaign signs on the lawn.
Right, exactly.
That's how old I am.
Some people still do study those sorts of things. But we have, these new emerging areas and questions. I think another thing that's important in political science is that we always sort of change and develop as a discipline. Political science is a largely quantitative discipline. Statistical analysis is, one of the primary tools that we use. And statistics change and evolve, and our ability to study questions changes and evolves. And so we can look at enduring questions in a new way or in a better, more sophisticated way. And so there is the sort of substantive content of political science, what are the important questions? And then there are also questions about the science part of it. How do we do our work? How can we do the work in a better way? How can we be more representative? How can we be more accurate? How can we be more predictive, right, which is sort of what we really hope we are able to do.
We've heard a lot of talk about political polling, and some people have suggested that because of the polarization that exists in the country, that individuals who are asked questions by pollsters clam up. They're reluctant to mm-hmm. either talk or to tell the truth because mm-hmm. of this fear that they're going to ignite criticism or get mean or dirty looks because of the position that they take. Do you see that as a threat to political science, the fact that gathering data may be more difficult?
Well, actually, in terms of the example you use in terms of polling, the biggest problem with political polling is cell phones because most well-done polling or public opinion polling is done using a method that we refer to as random digit dialing, right? When I'm calling a phone number, I'm generating phone numbers. I know 414 is the Milwaukee area code. I can generate 7 random digits, and most of the time, it will correspond to an actual phone number. People with cell phones don't answer any phones, any numbers that they don't recognize already. So the biggest threat that we have in political science to sort of understanding what the public thinks about any sort of issue is getting people to talk to us. The response rate in public opinion polls has been dropping dramatically. It's been dropping for about 15 years, but it's really dropping dramatically in the last 3 or 4. So if we can't get people to talk to us, we don't know what people are thinking. And then only when we can get them to talk to us can we hope that we can create survey questions and elicit a comfortable conversation that will allow them to reveal their true preferences. But the bigger problem right now is that we're having a lot of trouble getting people to talk.
So does that mean you might have to do more face-to-face, literally knocking on doors or intercepting people as they walk down the street or in the mall?
Face-to-face interviewing has always been the gold standard in political science. There's something called the American National Election Studies that was started in 1952, and it was face-to-face interview conversations for about 2 hours between a survey interviewer and a respondent. But that is so enormously expensive that it's very, very difficult to do. And the American National Election Study is really one of the only ongoing projects that used face-to-face interviewing. And even they're moving away from it now and trying to move to internet or phone polls because face-to-face is so expensive. So we have, some real challenges ahead of us about how we can speak to enough people and enough variety of people so that we can be confident that we've got a good representation of what Americans think. And this isn't just a problem in the U.S. This is, a challenge that everybody who does these sorts of techniques finds, no matter where they work.
So that's a good example of how political science, its own future is affected by the technology mm-hmm. that we all live with.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about the Democratic National Convention coming to Milwaukee. Can't yes. have you on without
so
without
excited.
This.
So excited.
So what does this mean to a political scientist? Like, is this heaven?
Yes. Yes, this is. This is like candy. So when Hillary Clinton ran, for president in 2008, I said, this is like my Super Bowl because I study women candidates and 2016 and now all these women. And the DNC being here in Milwaukee is just nirvana. I mean, it's just craziness. I can't wait to see and to watch and to hear. And, it's a different thing having all of these people in our community and having all of these things happen right here, much different than it would be for me to have watched it on television 4 years ago. So I'm hoping, to be able to attend some sessions. I'm hoping to be able to, talk to people. I think, there are always people who try to conduct research at conventions by talking to delegates, by, you know, interviewing people, talking to campaign managers, media people. You know, you've got all these people who make the machine of politics work. And so there are lots of people who study convention delegates and campaign managers. And so I know that there will be people, you know, here in UWM, you know, Marquette, Madison, trying to think about how we can use this, you know, as a just a great, rich data opportunity.
I suspect a lot of your political science friends may want to be staying at your house because there are no hotel rooms around for them to come to.
Yes, I'm sure.
What about students? Any opportunity for students to get a deeper understanding of the political process with a convention right here in town?
Oh, yes. And you know, the issue for all of us is going to be access, of course, you know, because these are not public events. And so, you know, to the degree that any of us, whether it's the political scientist or whether we could bring groups of students, you know, we're going to have to figure out access. But certainly for our students, you know, to really see what's happening. I mean, this would, again, just the impact of seeing it in person versus it being on television and the coverage, you know, that we'll get will be so much more intense and than it would be if it were happening somewhere else. So hopefully, you know, over the next year, we can figure out, you know, opportunities to bring students down or engage them in, you know, if somebody's going to do a research project, you know, that kind of thing.
Let's talk about today's student, the one that is sitting in your political science class. We hear that so many people are just tired, exhausted after 2 years of not knowing what's going to be tweeted in the next moment. Mm-hmm. Some people, they say, are being turned off to politics. What about college students? Do you see that turnoff factor, or is it drawing them in like a moth to a lamp?
Well, you know, I guess I would say that young people are not necessarily different than people of any other age with regard to their orientation to politics. And, you know, by that I mean I always joke in my classes that, you know, Americans put following politics right after their root canal on their list of things to do. And so, you know, I think the students in my class, so the students in my introductory classes, you know, who are students who come from the broad sort of scope of the university, you know,
represent three interesting credits, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly. So they represent the students who, you know, consume politics as often and as much as I do. And then there are students at the other end who are like, please just let me go home and not have to listen to this. Certainly political science majors, you know, and students who are studying this at a more in-depth level are generally students who are motivated and, you know, kind of passionate and connected. But I think that young people, they understand that all of the things that government is doing are very important to their lives. But young people are, you know, they're like everyone else. Their heads are down. They've got to get to class. They've got to get their homework done. They've got to get, you know, to their job. Young people don't vote at rates that equal people who are older, you know, say, than the 25-year-old age group, in part because they haven't entered the piece of life yet where government directly affects their lives. They're not worried about the school their kids are going to attend yet, necessarily. They're not worried about their property taxes going up if they're not owning homes yet. You know, we talk about why is the 18 to 25-year-old group the least likely to vote in American politics, and a lot of it is explained by the fact that they don't have those concrete connections to the outcomes of government.
No stake in the ground yet.
Not yet, right. Yeah. So, you know, from that same perspective, their sort of interest and attention to politics is somewhat varied.
Do you think that can change?
It does. Oh. It does change. I mean, what we see when we look at people across the life cycle, you know, they are less likely to vote. The people who are 18 to 25-year-olds now and who are not voting, by the time they're 45-year-olds, they'll be voting at much higher levels, very predictably. So voting takes sort of it's what we call a curvilinear relationship because it starts low and then it gets very high and it peaks about 65 and then it starts to fall off a little bit as people become older and infirm. Mm. But yes, so today's 18-year-olds, when they're 45, they'll be behaving differently.
And yet there are events that can occur in a young person's life that could trigger activism in politics. I'm thinking of the school shootings and what we saw down
certainly.
In Florida with with a whole class of students literally going to the gate and saying, "Stop this! We need to change our gun laws."
No, that is definitely true. And in political science, we talk a little bit about the socialization impact of generation. So those who came of age, say, during the Vietnam War, or those who came of age during Watergate, are different, perhaps, than those who came of age in relatively, you know, good economic times, relatively quiet, docile political times. So absolutely. I mean, young people who are coming of political age now in the, you know, in the world of school shootings, in the focus on climate change, you know, some of those kinds of issues will put an imprint on the sort of political orientations and activities of some young people.
You mentioned Vietnam, and I think of that today sometimes as I hear folks say, politics are so toxic. It's never been worse. You know, we are
1968?
Just in. I do.
Right.
So for the history, for people who have lived that history, this may be annoying or a bit maddening sometimes to listen to a newscast or pick up the paper and look at the latest outrage on the headline. But it's really not unfamiliar to American society to have politics at the root of our discussions and getting people impassioned and inflamed.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, we can look back at 1968. You know, 1968 was a real watershed year. People, you know, concerns in today's climate about, you know, the Trump presidency and, you know, are there impeachable offenses here and is this the worst it's ever been? Well, you know, Watergate was a pretty significant constitutional crisis, and that wasn't that long ago. But people who didn't pay attention or are younger now, this, you know, whatever's happening today feels like the most dramatic thing that's happened. And there really is a sweep of American history that suggests that we've gone through trying times and we've survived them, you know, to some degree. It can change our country. It can, you know, certainly change the trajectory moving forward. But this is, you know, what's happening today is never the first time we've had any particular experience.
And oh, by the way, there was a political convention in Chicago, 90 miles to the south of us.
That's right.
Back in the late 60s.
That's and, right. 1968 was very close to home.
Yep. So who knows what 2020 will hold for Milwaukee?
Well, we're going to hope it's not nearly.
I agree.
We're going to hope it's not like 1968.
I totally agree. But
there's no reason to think that it will be.
No. Not in terms of the violence, but just the world's focus, the world's attention.
I'm so excited.
You know, the whole world is watching. The whole world will be watching.
At least the whole country will be watching.
The whole world's going to be watching.
Right,
we have
fine.
Trump.
All
we have
right.
Trump to talk about.
No, I suppose that's true. No, the 2020 is going to be fascinating. It really will. Just, you know, in part because it will be President Trump's reelection, and, you know, who can the Democrats put up? You know, who could challenge. But just from the perspective of somebody who's lived in Milwaukee long enough now, you know, I mean, I'm delighted for the city and, you know, for the university because we deserve the attention that we're going to get.
Well, we are going to get it, and we hope to have you back on to continue the conversation and observe what is going to happen in Milwaukee in 2020. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
Great conversation. Kathy Dolan, a distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.